Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is an episode number which is yet to be determined. We're out live at in Redmond in a conference room in building number 92. I'm here with two special guests today, colleagues of mine who I will introduce in just a minute. And we've all been here for a Kubernetes bootcamp. So the topic is going to be surrounded around Kubernetes today. That's what we're going to talk about, especially the managed Kubernetes service that we have in Azure. But before that, let's talk. Let's have our guest, special guest, introduce themselves. And Daniel, I'll let you go first.
Hey, yeah, my name is Daniel Selman. I'm a Kubernetes consultant here with Microsoft, and I've been working with Rozi and Sujit for some time now, and excited to talk about some Kubernetes DevOps.
Hi, I'm Rozi Reyes. I'm a senior consultant, mainly focusing on microservices and blockchain.
That's right. We got two of the guys over here who can talk to us about the AKS service or the managed Kubernetes. Now, I know, you know, any Kubernetes story, any AKS Kubernetes story is going to start with an app, right? We want to take an app, and that app could be a simple web app with a middle tier and some back ends, maybe hitting some storage or database on the back end. Great canonical application. Mm-hmm. How do we take that application? Let's say, for the sake of argument, this application is written in ASP.NET Core, okay, which is a fairly popular framework these days. It could be Java, it could be Ruby on Rails or something different like that, but let's just say ASP.NET Core. Right? We're in the Microsoft building, so we'll talk about Microsoft technologies today. So I have an app, a web app, a API app, and some backends that are written in ASP.NET Core. How should I be thinking about these apps? Like, what if somebody has this app, how can they start the journey to moving this and deploying it into Kubernetes on Azure?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And what is really great about AKS is that the journey begins however far along in the maturity of your DevOps cycle you are. So let's say, for example, you're a relatively young DevOps DevOps organization. You don't have your CI/CD pipelines or any sort of automation built out yet. Kubernetes is able to be flexible with that. With AKS, out of the box, you can still run the same commands to containerize your applications using Docker, as well as then throw it on the cluster using kubectl or kubectl.
Okay. So you mentioned a lot of terms that I want to just peel back a little bit over here. So the first thing is, Rozi, Dockerization, right? That's the very first step in this whole process?
Yeah, absolutely. So think about Docker as like a lowest denominator. And just for, you know, for the audience here, you can actually run other type of container platform, just not Docker, but Docker is quite popular. So, but the idea is that when you start, you literally want to look into how your application will be packaged into container. That's really the first stop, and that's a little bit even before Kubernetes. But one thing really good about Kubernetes is the tooling around it. Like, it's so consistent. You can actually use for example, Docker for Windows comes with the Kubernetes single node cluster. Mm-hmm. Minikube is there. So there are tooling that basically give you the full fidelity without actually, you know, putting things into cluster, because, I mean, as a developer, the last thing you want is, like, deal with all these clusters. So once you get past that, when you have these sort of, like, up and running in your dev environment, let's say ASP.NET Core web app with an API, then your basic testing is done. Then the story goes to the next level. Okay,
Okay, so what you're saying is that as a developer, you first want to containerize this application and test it out on your own laptop or a machine locally first, right?
That's the ideal way because from the productivity standpoint, too, because before you do anything else, you want to make sure at least it's working.
Right, you want to debug it. If there's anything that has to be done, test it out. So you'd run it in Docker for Windows just as two containers, right? Let's say we have web container and an API container, you can throw them into Docker for Windows on your laptop, right?
Yes.
Or you could have a Mac or PC or whatever
it is. Doesn't really matter because Docker is supported cross-platform pretty much, and you basically will get a consistent experience. I tried it myself, and I think you know who did it.
Yeah. I know Razi has a Mac, I know that, and I have a PC. And I think that's, I said Docker for Windows, but I was referring to the product on Windows, obviously, which ironically can run both a Linux container as well as a Windows container. So just to be clear for our listeners, we're talking about a Linux container right now. We want to say, let's just assume the lowest common denominator, okay, somebody is running a Linux container, which does run in Docker for Windows.
Yeah.
Right? Or on a Mac, if you were to run the Docker tooling, what is it called on a Mac? Just Docker tools, or what do they call it?
So, I mean, when you install the Docker, the Mac version of it, it will basically set it up. Windows has a better flexibility because if you install Docker for Windows, you can actually package and test both Linux containers. They do run in a VM, it's a Mobi VM, but you will get opportunity to test them out and run them. And if you want to go with the native containers, you can always do that on Windows. So you can always switch, like toggle, you know, between the two.
You would try to do Linux operating system and a Windows operating system inside of the container if you wanted to.
Yeah, so your containers can be both Linux and Windows. Now, ASP.NET Core is a great example of cross-platform itself. So let's say in this case you're using Linux container to package these and run them, then literally your containers will run as is on Mac. That's the whole idea that you just take them and run them cross-platform.
Got it. Okay, so we've got the first step in, which is we've containerized these applications into a couple of images, let's say, right? That's what I call them. What's the next step in this process here?
Yeah, so the next step then is where do we put these images?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you don't want to just have your image sitting on your machine going stale.
Right.
Rather, you want to be able to have it in some sort of repository to send it to. And that's where Azure tooling really comes into play. So while there are open source things such as Docker Hub, which is very commonly used, Azure has its own offering, which is ACR, which provides a secure private repository for your Docker images. That's really useful in regards to both working with a small team to continue to develop these applications in a private environment, as well as the enterprise application as well.
And what kind of security do we have around ACR? Is that just use a username and password? Is that how people access it? How do you restrict such that, you know, nobody from the internet can just say, hey, let me just see what's in this repository.
So ACR is essentially the Docker registry, which we basically provide like as a hoster service. It's similar to like Docker Hub, but there are definitely some several differences. We have an SLA. You can actually use like an admin password and basically user ID and password. You can apply some other sort of like an RBAC-based attributes to it. Like that's, again, the Azure aspect to it. So the good thing about the ACR is that because part of the Azure ecosystem, everything that, for example, your ops is doing aligned with that. So, and I've seen customers like that a lot because they're already working on, let's say, AKS, working with X, Y, and Z, and then they say, okay, what is ACR? So having that conversation is also very easy. So think about like pushing into ACR is from a dev standpoint or from a technical standpoint, I would say, is the same command with the Docker. So there's no difference because the protocol is the same.
Mm-hmm. The familiar push, pull, whatever command.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's push and pull.
It's the exact same end user experience. But what Razi mentioned, though, and what's great is because it's part of the Azure ecosystem, you really get augmented capabilities as a result of that. For example, traditionally, if you're using a private repository for your container images, you need to go into the cluster, create some sort of secret that represents the authentication for that private container registry. Now, since AKS is sitting on the Azure Fabric, however, it's as simple as creating a Azure Active Directory service principle And then sharing, giving the AKS cluster permissions on that service principle for the ACR.
I see. So then anything that runs from inside of that Kubernetes cluster, you know, will have unfettered access to the cluster, but nobody else can just get in and pull down the images.
Exactly.
Unless they have the password.
Yeah, exactly. It what it really does is it just continues to lower the barriers for that developer experience and DevOps experience getting that application onto the cluster.
Okay, that's good. So now we've got these two images up in the registry. Like from a developer perspective, what's the next step here?
So usually what you will see in this scenario is you will have a source level, right? And again, from an AKS standpoint, that's a little bit down the lane. So we're talking about source right now, source code. Now, let's say you wanted to use Git and you wanted to use VSTS, basically. So you don't have to use like a Git as a system. You can use a traditional source control with VSTS. You wanted to push these things, and when I say these things, your code plus your Docker file. So your Docker file is critical because that's the definition of your container. So you will not going to necessarily use directly the image. You want it to build it automatically, because anything that goes beyond the dev environment have to be consistent. So the agreement here is that the Docker file that you're using essentially have all the things that you need, and they're basically in the source control. So your ASP.NET code is there, your API code, like your front end and the back end, all those code are there. Your Docker file is there. And that's basically when you can talk about, okay, so what's next? So the next thing going to be a build definition, which can consistently create that Docker image and can push it. In this case, we're talking about ACR, so it's going to be ACR. In
okay, so this is something that will run in something like VSTS, or Visual Studio Online. Oh, you know, what they call it Visual Studio now, right? What's the name?
VSTS, I think it's Visual Studio Team Services.
Okay, yeah. VSTS. So we'd run this in VSTS. It's some sort of a set of steps that we'd run in VSTS that would pull the source code out of VSTS, assuming your source code is checked in there, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This ASP.NET Core source code. Then what happens?
Yeah, so basically it's like a it's interesting. So it depends on your team, like what kind of a flow you have, like how often do you release and things like that will come into the picture. But at a very basic level, right? I mean, it's a really keeping it simple. You wanted to create a definition. If you want a continuous integration type of setup, then you can do that. There's a setting in VSTS for that. You don't have to. I mean, you can do on-demand. You can have some sort of conditions, like this many people should have reviewed all that. So you can do all those things, too. But eventually, what you really want to do is that kick off a build. And the build is set of tasks that you run. I mean, the simplest form, if you're trying out, you're new to it, you can basically just create a basic set of tasks where you read the code and you compile it. And the good thing about VSTS is that if you you have two options, you can actually run your own agents to compile, and because you have to create a Docker image at the end of the day, and Docker image will require a Docker on a agent, which is a VSTS agent. So you can use the hosted agent, or you can basically bring your own. So it's kind of like depend on you. Like again, some organizations I work with, they're just specific that hey, we want this version of Docker, and we don't want anything else. So they can bring their own, and again, there's a other conversation that you can have about the cost and all that. But the Visual Studio gives us to have a out-of-the-box agents, right? You can just use them, they're online, you could get them, and you can basically use them to create a Docker image from scratch. So let's say every time there's a check-in, you will take the code out, you will create a clean image, you will tag it properly.
So you're going to compile it, and then using the built-in Docker tooling, you're going to create an image out of this, right, as part of the steps?
Yeah, so you will basically choose a build task of basically which will create a Docker image.
That's all built into VSTS. There's nothing that you have to do. You just got to pick the right task and configure it.
Yeah, literally it's like a drag and drop. You find it and say, and you can make it as complicated again as you want, but typically to get it started, that's good, like pretty much like a good start.
The best analogy that I have for this, though, is that just as when you're building out your Docker file, you have declarative statements telling it what to do at each individual step. Mm-hmm. They're explicit statements. VSTS works just the same. It's the same experience.
It's like a huge workflow, essentially, that you're kicking off to do a bunch of steps.
Yeah, and so what I love about it is that I come from the infrastructure background, whereas both of y'all come from the development background. And so it really is the marrying of the two types of backgrounds. And so people from different types of skill sets and experiences can suddenly do the same task because it really is the marrying of the two of those.
Got it. Excellent. So what happens next? Now we've got this stuff. It's being we've created the image as part of the build definition. I'm still trying to figure out when does this go to Kubernetes.
So that's where a lot of the great add-ons for VSTS really have that value add.
Okay.
So they're native add-ons that you have for any Kubernetes tooling across the board. But specifically, there is Kubernetes-specific tooling to allow you to then integrate that into your cluster in both the build process as well as the release process. And so what this allows you to do as part of that build and release is not only create your container image, but then go that next step. Let's say you have the YAML ready. It's standard YAML.
The YAML for a pod or a deployment.
Yes. Right? Okay. The definition of the way you want your resources to be created. So that's saying, hey, this is going to be a container that's controlled by a replica set or a deployment, saying, I want you to keep this number of replicas every time I deploy this.
Okay.
And similar things like that, similar Kubernetes constructs. But essentially, it allows you to then not only define your containers, but also define what those resources look like in that VSTS build and release cycle. While also augmenting that with some of the native VSTS capabilities. For example, you have access to define your own variables as part of the build and release process. So let's say I want to keep track of how many times I have built this application, trying to get it to work every single time.
Build number, et cetera.
Exactly. And so you can have that caked into your cluster as well. You want to say, hey, I only want to have N minus one versions in my cluster. Well, every time that build and release happens, you can make sure that that's maintained.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the deployment to the AKS cluster is a story that is getting better and better. So it's like, you know, releasing into AKS is like you can, you know, do it in many ways. The point I would sort of like add to what Daniel has said is this is where you wanted to look into different type of tooling and what kind of tooling is a good fit for you, you know? So if you look at the VSTS and you talk about the release, the first thing you will do is that after creating the release definition, there are out-of-the-box Kubernetes tasks available. So if you do nothing, like absolutely nothing, and you say, well, I'm new to Kubernetes, I have a AKS cluster, tell me how to just deploy my ASP.NET Core application with the API. So what you really will do in that case is you need to make sure that your YAML files, like surveys, deployment, you know, pod definitions, they are there in the source control.
Checked in.
And usually, you know, what you want to do, you want to do some sanity check at the build time, like update the definition in terms of the you know, the image ID and all that. Exactly, build number. But once you do that, right, now you're ready to put things into AKS. Let's mm-hmm. say that's the first environment that you want to do it. So you basically will use the task provided by Microsoft, actually, and you can run the kubectl, which is the you know, the client tool, and you can basically and this is something that is very easy now. I mean, compared to like 12 to 18 months back. All you really need to do is that it's an integrated experience. So in VSTS task, you will connect to using your Azure subscription to the AKS cluster. And all you really need to do is that have that connection, and it will allow you to basically connect to the ACR, which is your container registry, where your build, when you run the build, your build actually pulls the images into the ACR. So you got that covered. You can also basically connect to the, you can create a service definition, which is a connection definition, to the AKS. So you basically will get the connection done with the AKS. That's the first thing you have to do, and then the ACR connection you have to do. Once that is done, then pretty much you're done, because all you really need to do is take your, for example, deployment file and make sure you just run it with a kubectl. So that's like a plain, like a linear way of doing that, like no extra tooling.
So with these steps, it's going to invoke the kubectl automatically from as part of the release definition in VS.
Yes.
Push it into AKS with the required number of replica sets, that were requested in the YAML file. So now that we have this running over there, what is the next step in this process, Daniel? What happens next?
Yeah. So naturally, as part of any DevOps cycle, once you have your application running, that's when the chaos starts happening. And so having a good monitoring story is essential. And I think that's also a really good place where AKS stands out. So there are a plethora of different monitoring experiences that you can have based off of your requirements. The easiest one that I've seen in my time working with AKS has been the native OMS integration. And so originally OMS had to be deployed as a daemon set across the AKS cluster. That experience has only gotten easier now that AKS is GA'd. And so now there's native OMS integration as well. So what does that mean? Well, essentially, if you have an OMS suite in your Azure subscription, all you need to do is include the workspace ID and some sort of secret, the passcode, for that OMS workspace, and the monitoring story just comes out of the box, in my experience.
So it drops an agent into all the nodes in the cluster, AKS cluster, and starts immediately sending telemetry to OMS.
Yeah, and so the experience is even customized for that Kubernetes and AKS experience using something called the container monitoring solution. Mm-hmm. And so what it does is it provides a real-time feed of monitoring of your containers, but not just your containers. So while you get to see, oh, I have 95 containers that are up and running, 4 pending, and oh, look at that, there's one tiny red bar there, one's failed, let me go and investigate that. That functionality is out of the box, so you get that visual experience, but as well as some sort of cluster level monitoring analytics as well.
Right. It shows you the pods. Does it show you all of that stuff?
Yeah, it shows you the pods, but it shows you the pods. It shows you the logs of the pods as well. Okay. But there's also some level of cataloging that I thought was really above and beyond. So in addition to seeing the pods, the logs, and a live feed, you also get to see an inventory of the number of distinct images that you have deployed within your cluster, the number of namespaces you have within your cluster. It really eases that that discovery process out of the box, because a lot of people, when they're first coming to Kubernetes, getting familiar with the tooling is a challenge and the verbiage is a challenge, but then also being able to properly navigate the different namespaces, that is the different types of views you can see when working with that tooling, can also be a challenge. And so that inventorying, I think, is something that out of the box really brings that monitoring story to the next level.
Very nice. Now, Ravi, so, let's assume this middle-tier API that we have is calling a Cosmos DB on the back end. Right? We have some database. That's the most popular one these days. And if there's errors, you know, there's some issues talking to the Cosmos, how might that kind of logging surface itself into OMS? What's the story over there?
So one thing I would say is the logging story really starts from the development side. There is an operational aspect to it, like, you know, if the connectivity is working or not. You can get quite a bit of that in OMS. But if you can use, for example, App Insights, or there are other instrumentation services that you want to use, App Insights is fantastic for that. You wanted to make sure that you take care of within the application, because because usually that's closest to the core of your application. Container is a it's definitely a packaging mechanism, right? So you can do that. There are other things too, which are going to take us a little bit further from the core, but it's an equally important discussion to have, is the construction of your application will determine a lot. So if it's like a microservices-style application, then you have to understand that each microservice is discrete. So if it fails, then it logs, and basically the service that depended on it capture that and fails gracefully. Mm-hmm. You don't want like multi-chain of these for like microservices
right
together.
It's like a virtuous cycle and it never recovers from
it. Yeah, you really don't want like five links deep and then something fails and you know you just eat that error. It's like that's a sin that you don't want to commit.
So it sounds like Application Insights is going to capture a lot of the application information, and then OMS, it sounds like, is more of the infrastructure information. Is that a fair statement there?
Yeah, no, that's a great way to frame it. And what's great about Azure, too, is that's not where the story ends either. Ooh. There's additional tooling as well, like Network Watcher, so if you want the network-level perspective as well.
And that works with AKS?
Yes, so there's something called the Network Watcher Agent for Linux, which you can plug into your Linux worker nodes on an AKS cluster, which allows you to have the same Network Watcher experience that you would have working with other Linux VMs or even Windows VMs. And it allows you to monitor that granular level traffic flow to both give you that insight into knowing what traffic is ports actually coming into, as well as knowing, you know, how I can best lock down the traffic in my cluster without disrupting any sort of flow.
Right. And I suppose Network Watcher is also useful if you're having any connectivity issues.
Exactly.
It'll tell you where there might be a break if you have a UDR or an NSG rule that's gone awry.
So in Kubernetes, one thing I will add is there are some native constructs that definitely, I mean, AKS support them natively because of the Kubernetes, is the readiness probe and the liveness probe. You can actually add those.
What's that?
So the idea is that when you start running the pods, there's a brief time before, you know, like the pods are ready.
Oh, yeah, it's got to load the container image, got to do the initialization and all that stuff.
So before the container becomes ready, exactly. So that is when you don't want to take the incoming connections, right? The thing is that because of the architecture of Kubernetes, it's sort of like always wanted to go and maintain a certain state. So the moment the container is going to come out, it, from a pod standpoint, is up and running. And essentially, it's not. It's probably going to take like millisecond to a few seconds before it becomes fully able to serve the request. So you want to make sure that you add that sort of like functionality, and you can do that. It can be exposed as a TCP sort of like a endpoint or a RESTful endpoint, and you can sort of like make the query. Yeah,
pinging it regularly.
Yeah. So if you really want to go into like a more like a production ready scenarios with AKS, you definitely want to look into all these, because if something fails, you definitely want to make sure that maybe it's not even, you know, and it's not having a false policy over there.
Yeah. And what would you guys recommend from a developer perspective? Do we see them having their own cluster, or is it one cluster per application, or should they all share clusters, or should they use something like namespaces? What's the general way they should do it? Like, this is I'm talking about the dev. Like, imagine a huge dev team, right?
Yeah.
That needs Kubernetes resources.
So I think it can be a little bit subjective. My personal opinion is that I would want my own one-node cluster, like a single node. And
just for you?
Just for me. And the reason really is that usually as a dev, you know, it's like a playground, right? You mess it up, and then you just want to quickly, you know, get rid of it and have a new one. And there's so many ways now. Like, I mean, you have Minikube, which is basically a single node cluster, and you can do actually quite a bit with it. I mean, there are a few things you cannot,
yeah,
but usually those are networking related or a bit more advanced,
right,
areas that you probably not even want to do anyways, but you can do quite a bit with it. And so I would, my recommendation is, generally speaking, is if everything stays the same, have your own. If you install Docker for Windows with Kubernetes, it comes out of the box. You can use that, or if you wanted to install it separate, like if you have a different machine for that, install Minikube and play with it. If you really have to go with a shared environment, I would recommend have it close to AKS, because it will save you a lot of time.
How do you mean? What do you mean?
So basically what you can do is that, let's say if you have a shared subscription model where you have like five developers, you know, using the same,
right,
then either each one can have their own AKS, or you can actually have a single AKS, and then you need to really go and have sort of like a hygiene that you have to do.
Right, or use something like namespaces maybe, where each developer can get their own namespace.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, so namespaces provide, for people who don't know, provide the ability to have a specific view of the cluster. So let's say you're working with an intimate team, you all work closely together. Namespaces are an ideal way to both properly utilize the resources that you have available while also providing that like granular level isolation, saying, hey, this is my namespace, this is what I'm going to work in. We each have our own namespaces. An alternative approach and maybe a more mature and closer knit application development cycle could be to have namespaces based on what level of development that it is in. So for example, we could have a cluster that has a dev namespace and then maybe a QA namespace as well. That would allow you to still keep it in that it's a prototype type of phase to get that rapid agile development while also really still maintaining the best use of the resources that you're providing.
No, that's good. So we went soup to nuts from a startup, from an ASP.NET application, all the way deployed to AKS and all the bits in between. Very good, very good. Thank you. So anything else, any other things that you'd like to pass on to our listeners as resources, maybe things that they could, do?
Sure. Me and Daniel, we are working on a series of blog posts, and I will share the link with you, so you can, the first part going to be out soon, so, I will encourage.
So you kind of walk them through some of these steps.
Yes, what we're trying to do is that we really wanted to make it easy because this is something we get from pretty much every customer, that, hey, it's all good. We wanted to build things on it and run it on Azure, but help us out here. So what we did is we created a very basic, as you said, right, ASP.NET and Node.js, sort of like a microservice, and we take, our readers through that journey, like, hey, this is the service. This is how you're going to put it on VSTS. This is how you're going to build the release, and then this is how you're going to deploy. This is how you monitor. So it's sort of like the full journey from scratch, right?
Right. And not just for developers, something for the IT folks as well, right? To see what the kind of flow is for applications.
Yeah, exactly. So similar to this conversation, we start off with an introduction to an application, and we walk you through what that journey looks like. But not only that, not only what you need to do to build this out, but also why. One thing that is really important, I think, from an IT perspective is understanding what are the motivating factors behind it, what are the situations you may encounter that may make you want to move in one direction or another. So having that transparency in terms of the types of thought processes, problems, and things like that that you may face is a big emphasis behind it, because there you can find oftentimes a lot of resources around being able to do anything around any Kubernetes capabilities. But the question is, what will lead me to want to do that? And so we want to provide the full experience from beginning to end, as well as kind of imbue some of the lessons learned.
Just one quick word. It's like, if you look at the tooling, it's evolving really quickly. Mm-hmm. So we go from like myself, when it started, there was just basically kubectl. You use that. Now we have tools like Helm and Draft. So we're going to cover actually Helm in the blog series. But the point is that when you start your journey, and doing these things, the tooling can be a little bit overwhelming. So making it easier is important, I guess. I mean, for anyone.
And isn't there, I saw someone in the workshop, some of the folks are using VS Code extensions, right, that have now plugins into Kubernetes as well, into AKS, and you can do a lot of the commands directly from Visual Studio Code.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Minikube is also now have some like extensions, so those things are getting better.
Yeah, and having that, working with VS Code heavily in terms of working with Kubernetes, the VS Code extensions are a lifesaver. So being able to recognize that, hey, there's a syntax issue in your YAML, you forgot a tab, for example, is something that's a lifesaver and will save you hours of frustration with really troubleshooting those small little issues.
Excellent. All right, I appreciate both of you guys making the time for this show today, and we'll look forward to your blog post. And maybe hopefully a regular series of posts so that we can walk our listeners through the same journey. Well, thanks again, Dan.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org, under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.